You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.
We are privileged this morning to have John Elmer. He is an independent journalist who has reported on the role of Canada in Afghanistan. We've reached in Amman, Jordan. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Many people see the role of Canadian foreign policy as benign, and many Canadians are very proud to claim that our country is a peacekeeping nation. How has the Afghanistan war, now on its eighth year, changed the Canadian world perception of Canada as a peacekeeping nation?
I think primarily the fact that Canada is fighting at the sharp end of the spear, if we can put it this way, against the Taliban in Kandahar province, the natural home of the Taliban, should put people out of that peacekeeping narrative. I mean, if it wasn't Afghanistan that put Canada out of the peacekeeping narrative, it could have been the Gulf War in 1991, or Canada's involvement in the war in Somalia in 93, or Haiti, Bosnia dropping bombs in Kosovo in 1999. We're part of the Desert Fox bombing raid on Iraq in 1998. Part of the Oil for Food program from 98 to 2003, the strangulation of Iraq. And of course, since the war in Afghanistan, Canada's played an integral role in, you know, in Palestine, where we're training security forces to buttress an unelected illegal government in Palestine. We're involved in the coup to overthrow the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 94-95 in Haiti. And so there's a long history of Canada doing much the opposite of peacekeeping. And if people listen to the soldiers themselves, they've been yelling for years that Canada's not a peacekeeping nation. The troops don't train for peacekeeping. Foreign policy isn't in a disposition towards peacekeeping, whatever peacekeeping even is. What Canada fights right now is active counterinsurgency in many of the most hot spots on Earth. And so this peacekeeping narrative is something that was good for policy throughout the 1990s as Canada tried to position itself after the fall of the Soviet Union. But for anybody that's been paying attention to Canadian foreign policy, the concept of peacekeeping has been out the window for quite some time, if it ever existed at all. And like I say, the Canadian forces themselves are quick to point out that it never existed at all, and that these peacekeeping missions in Bosnia were active combat situations. And as I said, Canada was involved in the aerial bombardment of Serbia in 1999 for 78 straight days of concentrated urban bombardment. And so Afghanistan was just, if we can say, provided a moment of clarity for Canadian foreign policy. And the positioning since 2001, since the war on the Taliban in particular in Afghanistan, it's been quite clear that Canada is not peacekeeping in Afghanistan. On the contrary, Canada is at the forefront of the counterinsurgency war, both in Kandahar as well as buttressing the illegal government of, now clearly illegal government of Hamid Karzai, who has no popular mandate whatsoever to rule, but is backed by the 150,000 foreign forces, you know, which Canada is at the forefront of.
Speaking with Noam Chomsky, he described early in the 1980s a culture of terrorism, with Reagan declaring the war on terror, and this signaling a shift in policies. Now, the world seemed to be united on the hatred of George Bush policies, and it seems that with the election of Obama, a new wave of change was welcome. Can a president be the change or the transformative element that we need?
Well, Barack Obama has been the opposite of a transformative element. If you're talking about a move away from war, he's quite openly escalated the war in Afghanistan and in Pakistan as well, with drone attacks that have escalated under his rule significantly and openly and proudly. You know, right away, The Economist put on its front page after the election of Obama, you know, they called it Obama's war. His presidency is integrally tied to the war in Afghanistan and the escalation of that war, and particularly the counterinsurgency war. He's put his own people on the ground, changed commanders, And so, you know, the streamline of the Obama administration is going to be defined by the war in Afghanistan, not a move towards peace, but on the contrary, an escalation of a war that gets increasingly more dangerous both in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but also for Canadians and the international community, if we're worried about things like safety within our own borders, we'd have to understand that Canadian actions abroad, or American actions abroad, as we've seen, precipitate a reaction from populations, and they have from time immemorial. If you attack people, they'll hit you back. And so if Canadians are concerned about security, they should be principally concerned about what Canadians are doing, tying themselves in so crucially to Obama's war in Afghanistan, a war that we see today. We now have 30,000 more Pakistani soldiers funded by the U.S., trained by the U.S., funded completely with a blank check since 2001, since September 11th, for all their military materiel. I'm not sure what the world was expecting from Obama, but he was quite clear that he was going to escalate the war in Afghanistan, and he's done that. As you say, we're now 8 years into a war that we were told was over in November of 2001, that the Taliban was defeated. Canadian forces hit Kandahar in November and December 2001 in what was considered a mop-up mission. And now, 8 years later, you have Taliban control of, you know, it's difficult to pinpoint, but control of virtually all of Afghanistan, meaningfully. Kabul, the capital, is under attack daily. The entire south is under Taliban control, as we can see by Canadian expressions and American expressions, the forward operating bases that the Americans have held down for the last 8 years are being vacated because they can't hold them, because Taliban pressure and resistance pressure in general. Generally, we refer to all resistance in Afghanistan as Taliban, principally because people aren't aware of the multiple factors at stake in a country like Afghanistan, which it's always important to note that Karl Marx was in Afghanistan as a reporter in the middle of the 19th century. Winston Churchill went to the exact province that the Pakistani and American troops are bombing each day in the Northwest Frontier Province in 1898 to fight what he at the time called the Talibs, the religious students who were fighting for autonomy over British, at the time, British India, right on the frontier. And so there's a long, rich tradition of resistance in Afghanistan that Canada and the United States and Obama in particular have put themselves right in the heart of.
And yet President Obama has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. I wonder if you could comment on the significance of this.
Well, if you look at the other winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, I think Obama fits in quite well. You have some of the most famous warriors of all time have won the Nobel Peace Prize, from Henry Kissinger to Menachem Begin, and the list goes on. So it's quite a dubious award if people want to look at the history of it. And I think, I mean, really, it would be hard to parody a peace prize more than the Nobel Peace Prize. This prize has been issued to, you know, like I said, some of the most blood-soaked leaders of recent times. And so I think, you know, you couldn't write a script better for Obama as he escalates the war, as the casualties on the ground increase, the number of internally displaced persons, the brutal conditions that people in Afghanistan are living under, the situation in Iraq, which Obama is quiet about, but is still going on, what's going on in Israel and Palestine, where Obama has been crucial in propping up an illegitimate government in order to cement a ghetto regime for the Palestinians, which he'll call peace. And so, like I say, you know, it's pretty much a joke. It's difficult to take it seriously, especially, you know, 8 months after he became president, to issue an award of this kind of, you know, so-called prestige without any record of peace whatsoever. And if people are willing to look at Obama's record since he took over. He's been a war president, quite the opposite of a peace president.
You began by talking about the narrative that guides Canadian perception of Canadian foreign policy. This narrative is filled with words that seem to captivate our imagination: the terrorist, the insurgent, you know, the duty to protect. All of this combined make for whatever direction our foreign policy takes. So let's start there. What is in the language? Who are the insurgents? Why is it important to understand who we are fighting against?
Terminology changes depending on its usage, its political expediency. So in Afghanistan, we're fighting insurgents. In Somalia, we're fighting terrorists. In Haiti, it was thugs. It's different names to describe the same people. And if you read the Canadian Counterinsurgency Manual, which was released 2 years ago and is a key training manual, insurgents are operators animated by ideas for social change and political change, challenging their governments. And so as far as that's concerned, Canada has structured its foreign policy quite explicitly to fight insurgencies around the world. And the focus is on Afghanistan today, but as General Andrew Leslie, the head of the Canadian Army, said, Afghanistan is a model, but it's not the model. And so you have to look at what's going on behind the scenes of the war fighting and see the apparatus that's being propped up in the Canadian forces and throughout the Canadian foreign policy establishment itself. And so we've used the vernacular of the three-block war to describe the war fighting paradigm for the soldiers, and that is sort of a mix on the ground of policing, so-called humanitarian aid, which we've seen is almost all security aid, and the war fighting apparatus itself. On the foreign policy front, they call it the three D's: diplomacy, development, and defense, which is of course not defense but offense, because it's a forward operating policy where you fight abroad so that you don't have to fight at home, which is the narrative that Afghanistan is quite clearly showing, as we have 2,500 Canadian troops on the ground. Now the eighth rotation and three more to go before the main combat troops withdraw. But the policy of the three D's is important to understand because it's a shift in the entire foreign policy establishment. It's not simply the war fighting element, but the diplomacy. You see Canada at the United Nations stalling for justice in Palestine. You see on a diplomatic level, Canada integrated deeply with the illegitimate government in Afghanistan, with advisors at the top level of Karzai's government. The fraudulent elections that took place under the auspices of Elections Canada and Canadian elections officials through the United Nations. And then the development apparatus is quite clear as well, where you see Canadian aid money going to train security forces around the world, be it Iraq, Palestine, or Afghanistan, Haiti as well, deeply illegitimate security forces that are designed to back illegitimate puppet governments that are put in place by Canada and the U.S. Through their diplomatic front. And so you have this sort of three-pronged attack and the entire, what the Canadians call a transformation of the foreign policy establishment. And it's happened hand-in-hand with the United States. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has been traveling the United States for the past 4 years, stressing the need for what Hillary Clinton's calling soft power. But the idea for diplomacy and development money to be used rather than the sort of shock and awe of George Bush, which is seen as illegitimate and ineffective, and rather to shift from the shock and awe paradigm to this counterinsurgency paradigm where you integrate within the illegitimate governments in order to buttress them, and you use special forces training and special forces on the ground carrying out black operations, rather than having all these boots on the ground that are seen, and rightly so, by the rest of the world as illegitimate. Occupation forces have been seen as illegitimate for quite some time, if not for time immemorial. And so the idea being that the effectiveness of the policy doesn't come strictly from the sharp end of the spear, but through the entire foreign policy establishment to carry out these operations more successfully. The idea is not to do it softer. The idea is to do it more successfully. And you do that in this high-tech age with special forces operating under the cover of secrecy, rather than, you know, the situation that they had in Iraq, where you have tens of thousands of American troops just sitting ducks for insurgent attacks, which both buttresses the insurgency and also limits the effectiveness of governments like Canada, the United States, and Israel as well, to carry out these wars, because it's not for Israel, Canada, and the United States, it's not about how many people they kill. It's about how many of their people are killed. And you can see that quite clearly in Canada's case in Afghanistan, where from 2001 till 2005, Canada was deeply integrated in the war, carrying out many important operations against insurgents, carrying out many attacks that led to the deaths of Afghan civilians. And nobody in Canada, very few people in Canada, and particularly within the communications and information systems, had any problem with that. And it wasn't until the summer of 2005, when Canada hit the ground in Kandahar province and took over responsibility for Kandahar province and started openly fighting the Taliban insurgency and started to die, that we've seen that it's much less popular every day than it was the day before. But you can link that directly back to the summer of 2005, when Canadian soldiers started dying 50 a summer, rather than what it was before, where you had just a handful of Canadian soldiers killed, mostly killed in friendly fire, so-called friendly fire incidents with the U.S. When that was happening, the war in Afghanistan was seen as legitimate, although the strategy hasn't changed at all, and the objectives haven't changed at all. What changed was that our boys, our Canadian boys, started dying, and when that started happening, people started questioning the efficacy of the operations. And so for the Americans and for the Canadians, it's important to keep legitimacy both within the so-called host government, that is, within Afghanistan and the population itself, but more crucially even, at home. And if the population at home stops supporting the war, as we saw, for example, in Vietnam, it doesn't matter how effective the soldiers on the ground are. If the population at home doesn't support the war can't continue. So it's crucial to Canadian and American objectives to have legitimacy both at home and an attempt to have legitimacy on the ground through puppet governments and whatnot. And that has led directly the deaths of Canadian soldiers to the unpopularity of the mission. Now you see on CBC for the first time commentators like Brian Stewart in his retirement show saying that he's actually now coming out against the war in Afghanistan after 7 years of being one of the most vocal supporters in the media of the war.
Now, many people would say that Harper has closer relation with the Bush administration policies and gave a pass to the Liberals' role in warmongering and see them as a more mediating or more a more middle-of-the-ground sort of party. Is there a difference? Because you mentioned if the people begin to reject the purpose of war and the actions of war, then you can force that change. You know, you can force your government to act responsibly. Where do we begin? Because our media tells us one is better than the other, and right now, according to the polls in the media, the Harper government is the more responsive government, and they have higher rating in the polls.
Well, I would challenge the idea that the Harper government is any different than the Liberals. It was the Liberals that took Canadians into Afghanistan in 2001. It was Liberals that took Canada into the counterinsurgency, to the heart of the counterinsurgency in Kandahar province. It was Liberals that supported the Conservative government through each of the four parliamentary motions that extended the mission in Afghanistan. I mean, independent of the fact that Michael Ignatieff is the head of the Liberal Party, when he was an academic at Harvard, was a crucial, if not the crucial, apologist and propagator of the war in Iraq through his justifications for the war in Afghanistan, which he openly called a colonial war, and the new imperialism is his terminology. It's the imperialism you get in the humanitarian age, is of course Michael Ignatieff's narrative, but his essays in the New York Times were crucial linchpins of the justification to expand the war from Afghanistan to Iraq. I would also challenge the idea that popularity on the ground in Canada affects policy, because you've seen in many of the countries involved in the war in both Iraq and Afghanistan that amongst the populations, the wars are deeply unpopular. And if people were to be polled in Canada legitimately and asked legitimately through poll questions how they felt about Canada's war in Afghanistan, you'd have overwhelming objection to the war itself. But that doesn't impact policy at all. We've seen that in Spain, we've seen that in the United States, we've seen that in many of the countries. I mean, look at the United Kingdom. Look at Britain's role in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're deeply unpopular. Some of the biggest demonstrations that have been seen on the streets in modern times were in London against the war, and it didn't impact policy whatsoever. So I think people have to be careful about thinking that simply speaking objections to these wars are going to make a change, because it takes more than that. It's quite clear. The war is unpopular in Canada. It's not changing. And in fact, what's not changing is that the entire infrastructure of war, of the foreign policy establishment, is being entrenched rather than challenged. And so, like I say, Andrew Leslie says it's a model in Afghanistan, but it's not the model. And when you have the entire foreign policy establishment, which is a big ship, you know, you don't turn these things around in a day. You're talking about a generational transformation that's happening within the Canadian forces. And like, you know, the saying goes, if you have a hammer, everything you see is a nail. And so when you see a situation like Somalia, where you have Canadian warships off the coast of Somalia, I think Canadians can expect that something is coming after Afghanistan, because the entire apparatus is being trained, funded, and created to fight these types of wars like Afghanistan for the next generation, because Afghanistan is a symbol of the type of warfare that needs to be fought by the Americans and Canadians going forward, because there's very little to distinguish generally in terms of strategic disposition from Afghanistan to Somalia, for example, where Canada has a rich tradition, as many Canadians are quite familiar. And it's important to note that it's not simply about withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, because as Canada withdraws its quote-unquote combat troops, it's going to escalate the other two Ds, the development and the diplomacy aspect, to continue along the exact same path that the war is going. So in fact, if Canadian troops, quote-unquote, pull out of Afghanistan, which they need to do because they're simply exhausted and their resources are threadbare, that actually the withdrawal of those Canadian combat troops from Afghanistan actually gives Canadians less influence on the war in Afghanistan, because Canadians will then, you know, the opposition will die down thinking that the war is, you know, from Canada's perspective, is over. And that's not the case. In fact, Canada's in it for the long haul in Afghanistan. And as we see in the anniversary of the eighth year, the war today is worse than it's ever been. So if Canadians think that the war, from Canadian point of view, is going to end in Afghanistan anytime soon, I think we're sorely mistaken.
Thank you so much for being with us. In closing, what would be something that each and everyone should do now?
I guess the question from Aman would be, where's the street protest? Where's the opposition? Where's the visible opposition to what Canada's doing? And more importantly, where's the vision beyond Afghanistan, so that the peace movement is not continually forcing itself to be redefined? I mean, where are the people that were on the streets in 2003, in February of 2003, in the largest street demonstrations that Canada has seen against the war in Iraq? Where's the population, where are the people that were in opposition to the war in Iraq right now, as the war in Afghanistan heats up so significantly? And I think it's important to understand that if there's no electoral option, people have to move their vision beyond the ballot box and seek alternatives to transform the political project, because Canada's entrenching itself within this project. And so, like I say, Afghanistan is not going to be the end of the story. So if the peace movement is simply focused on Afghanistan and simply focused on this misunderstood concept of combat troops and their withdrawal. They miss the fundamental counterinsurgency paradigm that the Canadian foreign policy establishment is being transformed to fight for the next generation, not for the next 2 or 3 years, but for the next generation. And so to keep our vision on the foreign policy establishment itself and not think that the war in Afghanistan is a one-off, but rather a vision of the direction of Canadian forces and Canadian foreign policy into the future, whether we're talking about Liberal or Conservative governments, because you have, as well, crucially, NDP support for this fundamental counterinsurgency paradigm through diplomacy and development aid.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is John Elmer. He is an independent correspondent in the Middle East. We reached him in Jordan. How can people access your reports and your writing?
I'm a correspondent for Interpress Service, Pacifica Radio, and the website at johnelmer.ca if people want to follow reports.
Thank you again. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Matin, coco la chanter, m'obliger lever. Pas gain temps pour café, même si m'connais moins gain congé. Wada gain de l'eau nanger, parce qu'elle dit m'y ouais danger. Il m'arrive entre les serrer, parce qu'elle connaît moins d'où aller. Les ranger sac moins, ak moins, même s'il pas v'lé. M'obliger est en silence, faut t'imonio pas réveiller. M'bayon de netibo, flopé dans robe bondje, yon akroula depuis malé. La ligne de rétin toujours ma pâtie pour toujours. Van caille, van bijou qui t'es misé, traîner sur le genou. Pas qu'il y a nous, pas qu'il y a un bonjour, fais noir qu'on fout. Pas qu'il y a nous en bacal, t'as qu'au bon animal, ça fait mal. Ça fait me songer sans cette moyen déraciné. Enchaîné dans les grillés, j'ai une différence, moi me payer. 5000 dollars t'es conservé, pas toi pas même déplacé. M'tombé transpirant chalet plus que 50 degrés. Qu'y a mon cap crié, t'y a mon cap crié. M'paroi des vents, m'paroi des yeux, tout m'en bouleversé. T'as qu'on son mauvais rêve, moi pas qu'à réveiller. M'encercler, m'emmerder. Chaque seconde qui passait, t'as qu'on son chenin qui est coulé, qui aime serrer. M'vérifier, au quoi j'aime t'es qu'on aime, t'as mettre la vie m'en danger. M'assoiffé. Rassasié, puis faut mon tomber malade, tout qui est mal nommé. Vomissement matière, fait qu'elle m'a chimé dans la mer. Côte infinie. Même capitaine bateau, par contre, s'il monte, s'il descend. Qu'est ton histoire, son malin. Si on monte à dire, pas ta chambre fréquente. Qu'est des trahis, moi, qu'est des mis chez moi. Vous allez étudier, mais étudier, c'est comme ça pour mourir. Le caillon du bateau, pour voir qu'elle n'en font plus. J'en papa, moi, dit, j'en maman, moi, dit. En bas la vie, dit, soleil, dit, sans pitié. Sacrifice, je fais, coup de poing, y'a, y'a, prends. Pour voir mieux, vie meilleure, c'est dans le bouche qui est ma terre. Pour me périr, pour me périr.
Mon bar, oui, amour, oui, son bateau. Pour regarder, pour rien dans le fond de l'eau. Mon vieux, oui, qui voyait Miami. Y'en pays qui chasse à nostalgie. Moi, en vie. On est tous les Haïti.
Y'a des femmes levées frustrées, pas envie parler. Même jouer esclave enlevé, envie pencher. Le fond qu'aime c'est les niages, dans tête moi c'est la rèche. Concentré d'un coup volcan qui prépond pour la vache. Nettoyer toute saleté, activer pauvreté. Embrasser tout le monde comme on t'a vivre dans la pauvreté. Depuis chèque, un échec, le point d'un coup c'est faux chèque. Nous faucher, nous travailler mais pas jamais toucher. Mâcher, chercher, pas dormir sans souper. C'est ça grand-papa me t'a toujours raconté. Qu'à des jours tu en mets, cherche ou pas trouver. Moi poisson, béton chaud, mon toujours long dalle tête chaud. Achète pas mon tête d'abord, bébé pas game pivot. L'or par quoi police, tchèque, on met ton en prison. Tant qu'on touchon, la vie ici tourne, y'en prend grand grand. Non, c'est le bagaille, m'va plaguer ma continue peu bon. M'va gâtonner, courant, y'en priorité, m'légaliser. Prends soin maintenant, ma famille, toute petite, moi. Nous songer, yo, c'est vrai, m'obliger, arrêter. En vrai, c'est réalité, payer, m'sans sécurité.
M'va pas envie à mourir sur le bateau. Pour regarder vos rêves dans le fond de l'eau. Mon vieux dit qu'il voyait Miami. Y'en pays qui chasse à nostalgie. Moi en vie, m'en vais tourner à ici. M'en pas envie à mourir sur le bateau. Pour regarder vos rêves dans le fond de l'eau.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.